This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The international community pledged more than $1.2 billion for humanitarian and development assistance for Afghanistan as the country teeters on the brink of a humanitarian and economic catastrophe. The United Nations remained in Afghanistan along with numerous international aid organizations. The population faced dire living conditions from years of conflict, severe drought, and COVID-19, even before the government collapsed and the Taliban swept into Kabul on August 15th. The UN appealed for $606 million for the remainder of the year for food, health care, shelter, and other vital needs to assist 11 million people. The country's poverty rate is spiraling, public services are close to collapse, and the UN says many people could run out of food by the end of the month as prices climb and salaries and savings dry up. With winter approaching, humanitarians urgently need to pre-position food and other supplies in areas where access will become difficult because of bad weather. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, testifying at a congressional hearing Monday, staunchly defended the country's military withdrawal last month from Afghanistan. Speaking to the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Blinken said there was no evidence that staying longer would have made the Afghan government any more resilient or self-sustaining. Opposition Republican lawmakers and some Democratic colleagues of President Biden have criticized the president's handling of the withdrawal of troops, American civilians, and Afghans who worked for U.S. forces. The U.S. evacuated 124,000 people. Blinken's expected to face more tough questions on Tuesday when he appears before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. This is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden is using his first Western swing since taking office to hold out the wildfires burning across the region as an argument for his $3.5 trillion infrastructure plan. He is calling year-round fires and other extreme weather a climate change reality the nation can no longer ignore. With stops Monday in the states of Idaho and California, Biden sought to boost support for his plan, saying every dollar spent on resilience would save six in the future cost. He said the rebuilding must go beyond simply restoring damaged systems and instead ensure that communities can withstand catastrophic weather. Weather, he said, does not strike based on partisan ideology. Voters in the U.S. city of Boston, Massachusetts, will head to the polls to pick two candidates to run in the November 2nd mayoral election. Until now, Boston has only elected white men to the mayor's office. This year, however, all four major candidates are women of color. Four other candidates are on the ballot, but polls indicate none of them will get more than 3% of the vote. U.S. Capitol Police said they arrested a California man early Monday near the Democratic National Committee headquarters in Washington, and that multiple knives, a bayonet, and a machete were in his truck. It is illegal to carry a bayonet and machete in Washington. Police said the arrested man, Donald Craighead, 44, of Oceanside, California, told them he was on patrol. Craighead was charged with possession of prohibited weapons. Police said he noticed the truck Sunday around midnight. It had a swastika and other white supremacist symbols painted on it. Instead of a license plate, police said the truck had a picture of an American flag. Police said that they are continuing to investigate the suspect's security, and the area remains high. It is only a few blocks from the U.S. Capitol building, the site of a break-in by an angry mob of supporters of former President Donald Trump. On January 6th of this year, those supporting the more than 600 rioters arrested 8 months ago are planning a rally in Washington this Saturday. And Norwegians voted in general elections Monday. Official projections based on preliminary votes indicate that the governing conservatives will lose power after a campaign dominated by climate change and the future of Norway's oil and gas exploration industry, or exploration. The Labour Party and the allied socialist left and Eurosceptic Centre Party are projected to get 100 seats in 169-seat parliament. There's more at voanews.com. Via remotes, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Guinea's military leaders will meet today with politicians and civil society groups.
We are going to listen to what they have planned to do, and on our side, what we think the transition should be and what the agenda of that transition should be.
Tanzania's president names the country's first female defense minister. South Sudan's delegation to the UN General Assembly says it wants support for the country's peace process. An e-business registration system puts Benin on the map as one of the fastest growing countries to start a business. And the UN says the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region threatens to spill over to the whole Horn of Africa.
From my last update to the Council to date, allegations of human rights violations have continued to implicate government forces and its allies. We have received disturbing reports that local fishermen found dozens of bodies floating along the river crossing between Western Tigray and Sudan in July.
And a Ghanaian photographer will talk about his photography library and center in Ghana. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Politicians and civil society groups in Guinea are meeting today, Tuesday, with the military junta to discuss putting together a transitional process following the September 5 coup d'etat that overthrew President Alpha Condé. Faya Milimuno, leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party, says the only minor disagreement that may exist among the politicians is about how long a transition process should last. He says some are advocating for a shorter transitional process, perhaps 18 months, the same as in 2010. But Milimuno says 18 months will be too short because there's a lot to do during the transition period, including writing a new constitution, investigating possible economic and other crimes, creating a new voter list, and putting together a new electoral commission.
We are going to listen to what they have planned to do and what we would expect to be allowed to say on our side, what we think the transition should be and what the agenda of that transition should be, also how long the transition should go through.
So who requested this meeting, the politicians or the military junta?
It is the military junta requesting the meeting. They will start with the political parties, followed by the civil society and all other constituencies.
This is coming on the heel of the ECOWAS delegation returning from Conakry. What's the feeling there from the meeting of the ECOWAS delegation?
The ECOWAS delegation, they came to meet with the junta, and they have given the message to the junta. But as far as the Guinean people are concerned, we consider the ECOWAS leaders as being part of the problem, not the solution. We have called upon them to intervene to prevent the crisis from happening. They didn't listen. Now that the crisis happened, they should let Guinean people manage the situation and solve the problem.
From the viewpoint of the Guinean politicians, do you people feel that the military junta is doing the right thing so far since they took over?
No, we cannot at this time make any conclusion or any evaluation of what is been going on. What we know is what they have done so far is going to the right direction. They have set all the political prisoners free, and everybody here appreciates that. They have started the consultations among Guineans to define together the agenda and the objective of the transitional period. And they put justice as something important to the point that everybody should abide by the law. And we have seen so far that they are doing the same thing. At this time, there is no way for us to doubt about what they're doing, but we have to remain vigilant, especially to be involved to avoid any problems.
How united are the politicians in Guinea about this whole transitional process?
There is no major opposition among the political parties. If there is an issue on which we may have some difficulties is the length of the transitional period. Some are advocating the fact that the transition should go very quickly for about 18 months to be concluded. That is what we did in 2010. This time, we need to take time and do things right.
Are you saying the 18 months in 2010 were short or long?
They were short. There are so many things to be done before going to those elections.
Including what?
Including the writing of the new constitution, including investigations to identify whoever has committed any economic crime or any other crime. We have also to recreate a registry. We have to put a completely new electoral body to manage the elections. And there are many other issues to take care of before really going to those elections and consider them as fair and free.
Fayemi Limuno is leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, says the increasingly brutal conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region threatens to spill over to the whole Horn of Africa. Preliminary findings of a joint investigation by the UN Human Rights Office and the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission into alleged violations in Tigray have been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Since the last update in June, fighting has continued unabated in Tigray and has expanded into neighboring Afar and Amhara regions. Human rights chief Bachelet says mass detentions, killings, systematic looting, and sexual violence have displaced nearly 2 million people in this region and has created an atmosphere of fear. She says civilian suffering is widespread and impunity is pervasive. Bachelet says investigators have documented multiple allegations of human rights violations, including extrajudicial killings, torture, and enforced disappearances. She says sexual and gender-based violence, including gang rapes, have been characterized by a pattern of extreme brutality and ethnically targeted.
From my last update to the Council to date, allegations of human rights violations have continued to implicate government forces and its allies. We have received disturbing reports that local fishermen found dozens of bodies floating along the river crossing between Western Tigray and Sudan in July. Some allegedly had gunshot wounds and bound hands, indications that they might have been detained and tortured before being killed.
The Ethiopian government declared a unilateral ceasefire in Tigray at the end of June, nearly 8 months after it began its military offensive in the region. Shortly after, Tigrayan rebels retook the capital, Mekele. Bachelet reports Tigrayan forces have perpetrated many human rights abuses since gaining control of parts of Tigray and expanding to neighboring regions.
During the period under review, the Tigrayan forces have allegedly been responsible for attacks on civilians, including indiscriminate killings resulting in nearly 76,500 people displaced in Afar and an estimated 200,000 in Amhara. More than 200 individuals have reportedly been killed in the most recent clashes in these regions, and 88 individuals, including children, have been injured.
Bachelet says accountability for human rights abuses and a national reconciliation process are the only solution to the conflict in Tigray and to achieving a sustainable peace. The chief of the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, Daniel Bekele, says all parties to the conflict have committed violence against civilians, including sexual violence and use of child soldiers. But he notes the situation in Tigray is complex. He says the commission is still analyzing the information and evidence gathered and is not ready to share any findings and conclusions at this stage. He says the commission's findings, conclusions, and recommendations will be contained in the final report of the joint investigation to be published November 1st. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Tanzania's President Samia Suluhu Hassan has named Dr. Stergomena Lawrence Tax as Defense and National Service Minister. She becomes the first female cabinet minister to hold that position since the country gained independence. Until her appointment, Dr. Tax was the Executive Secretary of the Regional Bloc Southern African Development Community, SADC. The appointment was part of a mini-cabinet reshuffle over the weekend. For analysis regarding the latest appointments and expectations of the new cabinet ministers, VOA's Peter Clote reached Fatma Karumi, former president of the Tanganyika Law Society.
They are two very, very important new decisions that have been made, or appointments that have been made. One of them is the return of General Yusuf Makamba into cabinet. He's a young man, he's somebody who was in the Magufuli cabinet and was removed by Magufuli and was sidelined for a prolonged period of time. He is a Kikwete man, and so you can see that there is a move to bring in some of the people who were sidelined by Magufuli. The next person is Professor Mbarawa. Again, Professor Mbarawa is somebody from Zanzibar, and he's come in as a full minister. It's the first time in a very, very long time that we have had a minister from Zanzibar as full minister in the cabinet of the United Republic of Tanzania.
You have a new female defense minister for the first time since the country's independence, Dr. Stergomena Tax, who was then heading the SADC. Talk to me about her appointment and what this signifies.
What it signifies is that the president is not threatened by other women, and she wants to showcase talented women. And she made it clear today in the appointment speech that she wanted to show that women could lead a ministry such as the defense ministry. What is also clear is Dr. Tax has always been a 50M stalwart. This is a little bit sad, given the fact that actually she is supposedly a professional civil servant and went on to serve as an international civil servant. So I find that a little bit disheartening that she's now been brought into cabinet, because what it's clear is that she's a CCM hardliner, and she has been CCM because she must be a party member before being appointed.
Well, some people are saying expectations are high, but that she has the ability, she has the credentials, and she's experienced enough to meet the challenges of the office, especially she being the first female to hold that position. What is your take?
Well, I'm through, Peter, sort of judging people until I see how they perform in that particular position. I will wait and see. I'm not going to say she's going to do a good job. I will wait and see. If she does a good job, I will say she's doing a good job. And I'm not going to say she's not going to do a good job. My opinion is out. The jury for me is out at the moment. I'm just going to have to see how she behaves.
Fatma Karumi is the former president of the Tanganyika Law Society. She was speaking with VOA's Peter Clote from the Tanzania commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 14. The spokesperson for South Sudan's President Salva Kiir says the country's delegation to this year's UN General Assembly comes with an appeal to the international community to support the implementation of Chapter 2 in the country's revitalized comprehensive peace agreement. Ateng Wekateng also says the delegation, led by Vice President Rebecca Nyanden Demabio, will ask the UN to lift the arms embargo against South Sudan because, he says, the country cannot put together a national army under an arms embargo.
Yeah, I'm here with the Vice President Rebecca Nyandeng, who is the head of the presidential delegation to the 76th United Nations General Assembly. Vice President Nyandeng was delegated by His Excellency President Salva Kiir Mukadid to represent him in the 76th session of the United Nations.
So President Salva Kiir could not come?
Yeah, he could not come because he has other commitments that are actually very much important than coming to the General Assembly.
What message is South Sudan bringing to the General Assembly?
South Sudan is bringing a lot, including asking the international community to help in the implementation of the Chapter 2 in the revitalized peace agreement on the resolution of conflict in the country, which is almost frustrated by the armed embargo, because you cannot train the security that you would be calling the national army of the country, and at the same time you are imposing an armed embargo. That two things don't go together. And also the vice president would be giving the speech on the achievement the government of South Sudan has made so far in regards to the security situation in the country, which is crucial, and many other things.
Two things. The achievement the government has made so far. The agreement was signed in 2018, the revitalized peace agreement. Are you saying there have been some progress right now?
Yeah, there are some progress. Yes, but if you see, there's no major fighting that has been taking place anytime apart from the whole outbreak, who are actually causing havoc, and they are killing civilians on the way from Numili to Juba. But peace has been holding between the major parties in the agreement.
So you mentioned, I think South Sudan is going to argue for the lifting of arms embargo. How would implementing the revitalized peace agreement go with lifting arms embargo when some people may argue South Sudanese are killing each other?
Well, South Sudanese are no longer killing each other in the magnitude that would have had if the revitalized peace agreement was not signed. Because, you know, fighting, the major fighting that was taking place as communal fighting which in isolated cases are being tackled by the government. So there's no any major battle that you talk about South Sudanese killing themselves from.
The South Sudanese Minister for Cabinet Affairs was quoted as criticizing what he called the reluctance of some members of the international community for not funding the peace process in South Sudan. Was this an isolated incident by this minister?
No, the minister was talking about the lack of commitment by the international community to do its obligations in regards to supporting the implementation of peace agreement or resolution of conflict, which is crucial. And the fact that the international community is not looking at the positive aspect of what the parties in agreement have done is also frustrating.
Before I let you go, I read this article. Maybe you can clarify. It says that South Sudanese diplomats have not been paid for 2 years. Help me to understand, is this true or is this false?
Well, I don't have much detail about the article in question. I know we have been having some challenges in paying our diplomatic staff, but it shouldn't be said to be going to that 4 or 2 years now.
Atain Wekatains, the spokesperson for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. You are speaking with us from Washington, D.C. Early in the COVID-19 pandemic, Benin set up a service to allow people to register their businesses online. The e-registration system has worked so well that this West African country is now the world's fastest place to start a business, according to a UN agency. Moki Edwin Kinzeka Nairis, this report by Anne Nzuanku in Cotonou, Benin.
Sandra Edusu is the owner of a store selling art in Cotonou, Benin. She submitted her business application online and received approval and legal documents within 3 hours. She says if there was not this facility to create a business online, if one had to go stand in line, wait in line, go through the maze of administration to start a business, she wouldn't have done it. It's as simple as that, she says. She would have stayed in the informal sector. To create her business, Sandra went online to monentepeace.bj, a platform in Benin, to create and formally start a business. The site was launched in February 2020, by the country's Investment and Export Promotion Agency. It was the start of the pandemic, and the agency did not want people to come into their offices. Applicants fill out the required information, download the required documents, and make a payment online. The documents arrive at the agency's headquarters, where staff verify the information and mail business certificates to those who are approved.
En 2019, nous étions à...
Laurent Gambis, the general manager of the Investment and Export Promotion Agency, says in 2019, the agency was at 28,000 businesses created. And in 2020, the figure went to over 41,000 businesses created. He adds, for him, this has been a good performance. It shows to the agency that the platform has been accepted and today it processes an application in 3 hours. The online service helped make Benin the fastest place in the world to start a company, according to the UN Conference on Trade and Development. The businesses must be located in Benin. However, people abroad can use the service if they are in the process of setting up a business inside the country. Economists like Albert Holunku see big benefits for entrepreneurs. He says the online service reduces costs, it reduces delays, and it avoids corruption. It also avoids carrying papers around. And in the COVID period, it avoids contacts and also avoids the lengthening of delays. The Investment and Export Promotion Agency says it will continue to review the procedures and dialogue with the private sector to further improve the process. For Anne Zwanke in Cotonou, Benin, Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News.
A Ghanaian photographer has raised more than $1 million for a photography library and center in Ghana after his story was published on the photography blog Humans of New York. Paul Nissan, who currently is studying photography in New York City, spoke to Ricky Stryak about his plans for the Deakin Center in Ghana and the conversations and learning he hopes it will host.
I'm looking to build it in Ghana, for that I know for sure. But the location, I do not have it yet. You know, I just raised money. I'm still raising money. You know, the 1.2 million kind of fully complete the whole project. So we're still raising money off the bat. And we right now we've had offers from ministers and people in Ghana who believe in the project and want them. They want it to have it in their constituency. So we're still in touch and we're still discussing and see how it goes.
Can you tell me a little bit about why you had this idea, why you had this vision, and what you think it will bring to potential photographers in Ghana, but also storytelling in the region in general?
I think that it's time Africans tell their story. I think it's time Africans become part of the conversation. I believe the insider and outsider perspective, I say, you know, yes, we need outsiders to tell stories of Africa in their perspective. But again, we need to train other Africans to be able to do this. And for me, the thing I'm trying to do is provide resources for Africans to have a place and the resources to tell and be trained to tell their own stories.
Building this center, will there be any kind of focus, not just on photographers, but on the relationship African non-photographers have with the visual image? Because I think, you know, if you look at local papers and things like that, often photographers on the continent in their local newspapers, they aren't as valued as maybe they should be as well.
Exactly. You know, I am not thinking this project is not just for photographers. It's not just for filmmakers. It's for even the people who consume content. It's even for the media, you know, because now most of the media outlets in Ghana are limited, in Africa are limited in their resources. How do you hire a full photographer to go around taking pictures? It's expensive, you know. So how my thing is like, how do I lead the conversation? You know, how do I bring resources to help other newsrooms, to help photographers publish their work, consume content? If we are talking about climate change, we are talking about democracy, we are talking about poverty alleviation and development in Ghana and in Africa, how can we use photography and filmmaking to do this?
That was Paul Nissan, a Ghanaian photographer and founder of the Deakin Center. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from New York. And that's it for this Tuesday, September 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely